which is good. So let's go to John chapter 11. That's where we left off. And again, if you're visiting, we just try to go through the whole scriptures. We finished John chapter 10 last week. We're hitting John chapter 11. This is an important chapter because it's the seventh definitive miracle that John lists. There were seven that he keys off of for specific teachings that Jesus makes, sign miracles. Of course, he did many. John is the one, I believe, who says that, you know, if everything that he did was written down, fill all the books. But he chose these specific ones that we might believe. And we come to a situation. Let's read a couple verses and look. Verse 1, it says, "Now a certain man was sick, named Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. It was that Mary which anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Therefore his sister sent unto him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom thou lovest is sick." Lazarus, New Testament version of Eliezer, name means whom God has helped. There are two Lazaruses in the New Testament. This is not the Luke chapter 16 one, the beggar who sat at the gate and the dogs licked his sores. That was not this. This is a different Lazarus. This is a Lazarus who has two sisters, Mary and Martha. We're giving three different snapshots into their life. It's always together, you know, Mary and Martha. It's not Mary by herself or Martha by herself. Two very different ladies, part of a godly home, a place that Jesus goes for rest. They're his friends. He'll go there when he needs a break. And it's funny, it happens. Here's a godly family, one that knows Jesus, and yet we see sickness hit this house, sickness and also death. If you've been brought up on the prosperity gospel that God never wants you to be sick, God never expects you, you know, he wants you to walk in divine health and that death will never touch you, somehow you're going to be different than every other person that's ever walked the face of the earth, you've been deceived. And here it hits this home. And it's very insightful to see how these two ladies deal with it. It says it was that Mary that anointed the Lord with ointment. It's recorded in Matthew 26, Mark chapter 14, and then it's going to be again in the next chapter, where before Jesus' crucifixion, Mary comes in, very expensive ointment, breaks it open, almost like a year's wages expensive. You know, you imagine bringing in something that costs $20,000, $25,000 in our money and pouring it out on the Lord. Matthew and Mark don't name her. John's written a lot later. Certainly at one point early in the church, persecution arose. And so, quite possibly, they didn't name her just because they didn't want her to be, you know, singled out for that. But John, much later, Mary, I'm sure dead by the time he wrote, says it's Mary that did this, anointed the Lord with ointment. And we're told everywhere the gospel is preached, that will be remembered as a memorial for her because of the thing that she did. And, of course, we're mentioning it today and will again next Sunday, so certainly that was true, the Lord not lying. Their brother gets sick, Lazarus. And when Lazarus gets sick, the sisters know what to do. They've been around Jesus long enough. They're friends with Jesus. And they know that he's going to do something. He has to do something if he knows. So it says in verse 3, "Therefore his sisters sent unto him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom thou lovest is sick." They don't say, "Jesus, the one that really loves you is sick. You know, he really loves you, Lord, so you need to do something because of his great love for you." They don't appeal to Jesus because of Lazarus' great devotion. They appeal to Jesus because they know that Jesus loves Lazarus. The word lovest that they use there, it's phileo, it's fond of. Jesus, it's a guy you like, your buddy, the one you like, Lazarus, he's sick. You have to do something. And they know because of who he is that when he hears that, he's got to do something. Those of you who are parents, you know, if someone came in and said, your 3-year-old is out playing in the street, you wouldn't say, well, what do you want me to do about it? No, you'd drop everything and you'd go get that kid. You'd rescue that kid because you love the kid. And here they appeal to Jesus and they say, Lord, the one that you love, you're really fond of, he's sick. They don't even have to say, we want you to do anything. And you know that, for me, I know when I appeal to Jesus a lot, my prayers, they contain the therefore clause, you know. Lord, this is going on, so therefore you need to do this. This is what you need to do. They don't feel a need to do that. They know him well enough that all they have to do is bring the need to him, and he is going to do what's necessary. However, it's not as they would have thought. We're going to see. It says in verse 4, and when Jesus heard that, he said, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby. I'll ruin the punchline up front. He dies, okay? He dies and he's in the ground for several days. And yet here's Jesus saying, the sickness is not unto death. You know, how do you reconcile those two things? Well, and we're going to see as we get through this, death to Jesus is a little different than maybe death to you and I. Jesus hears that he is sick. He says, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby. You know, we sang that last song. Take my time here on this earth, let it glorify you for all you're worth. Oh yeah, hands up. Oh Lord, let my life glorify. This is how Lazarus glorified for all that he was worth. This is how Mary and Martha allowed their life to be glorified for all they were worth. To go through this brother dying at an untimely death, if you can say that. I mean, how, you know, everybody dies. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. Jesus says this sickness is not unto death. Now, we're not giving the exact timing of all of this. Well, look at the next couple verses. It says, now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. And that word is agapeo. It's the divine love. It's beyond just being fond. He loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. And when he heard, therefore, that he was sick, he abode 2 days still in the same place where he was. How do you really reconcile that? Jesus loved them, so he didn't go, you know? I want, Jesus loves me, so he comes right now. That's for me, that's Jesus loves me, is Jesus is here. I'm in trouble, Lord, there's a problem, you got to be here right now. Yet, Jesus loves him, so he abode 2 days in the same place. Now, we're going to see when he gets there, he's only a couple miles away. Lazarus has been in the ground for 4 days, so it almost seems as if as soon as the messengers went out, he died. So he's already been dead at the point that the messenger comes to Jesus. Yet Jesus says, well, this sickness isn't unto death. So, of course, the messenger's thinking, oh, whew, that's great to know. I'll go back and let him know the good news. And so they trot back because Jesus hangs out for 2 more days before he goes, only to get there and find out, no, he's in the ground at this point. See, we have a tendency, maybe it's just me. If this isn't you, if this is just me, then you can just feel bad for me because you're a whole lot more spiritual than I am. I have a tendency to think, well, if you love me, you wouldn't let me experience any pain. If you really love me, you'd protect me from all the hard stuff. This is Steve. I'm your pastor, Lord. I'm the one. You know, you're not going to let me go through anything hard. But yet, it's not that way. It's because I love you, I allow things to be measured into your life. He abode 2 days in the same place where he was. Then after, he saith to his disciples, well, let us go to Judea again. And his disciples say unto him, Master, the Jews of late sought to stone thee, and goest thou thither again? The King James just doesn't really do that any justice. Okay, now think about this. They've been going in, we've gone through John chapter 8, John chapter 9, John chapter 10, where he's just butting heads with the religious leaders, and they're telling him he's possessed, and he's born of fornication, and he's telling them that they're going to die in their sins, and they're going to hell, and children of the devil. I mean, it's been nasty. They keep picking up rocks. Last time, remember, they picked up rocks again. They wanted to stone him, and yet he just goes out through the middle. So now he says, well, hey, let's go back. And his disciples, they didn't sit around and, you know, like they're at tea time saying, forsooth, the Jews of late have sought to stone thee. Goest thou thither? They're like, in modern day English, are saying, are you insane? Wait, they're trying to kill you. Don't you understand? They're trying to kill you. You don't want to go back there because they want to kill you. They keep grabbing rocks. We're away. We've escaped a couple times. Do you think this is going to happen every time? Jesus, come on. What are you nuts? They've already seen him several times, you know, like when the centurion came and said, sent someone and said, my servant is sick. And Jesus, well, I'll go. And the centurion servant said, no, he's not even worthy for you to go to his house. Just say the word and he'll be healed. And Jesus says, you know, wow, I've never seen such faith. Just be healed. And he's healed from a distance. So they're thinking, Jesus, how about let's reach out and touch someone long distance on this one? Because there's rocks back there. I don't want to die. You don't want to die. We've got away these last couple times. Are you insane? They're trying to kill you. And look what he says. Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours in the day? If any man walk in the day, he stumbles not, because he seeth the light of this world. But if a man walk in the night, he stumbles, because there's no light in him. This verse kind of messed with me a little bit. Because they're saying to him, don't you understand they want to kill you? And then he says this thing about day and night and walking in the light. And I'm like, not really getting that. But then when you go back, if you remember from chapter 9 with the blind man, he said something similar. The disciples, they came across this man that was born blind. And the disciples say, Lord, who sinned, this guy or his parents, that he was born blind? And Jesus' answer in John chapter 9, verse 3 is, Jesus answered, neither has this man sinned nor his parents, but that the works of God should be made manifest in him. And then he said, I must work the works of him that sent me while it's day. The night cometh when no man can work. As long as I'm in the world, I am the light of the world. And Jesus was saying, look, I'm here. While I'm here, it's daytime. I have work to be doing. I'm doing the Father's work. When it's light is when you work. You know, we live in an era of shift work and swing shift at the mill and you know, up burning the midnight aisle, midnight oil on your computer under the lights. Back in the day when you're, you know, an agricultural society and you're a farmer, you're up when the sun comes up, you go to bed shortly after it goes down, and that's, you work when the daylight hours are on. And Jesus is saying, this is the day, I'm here, now's the time for me to work. He's telling them here, when they complain and say, Lord, they're trying to kill you, he's like, you don't understand, it's still day. He says, there are 12 hours in the day. And yeah, and 12 hours in the night, you understand, roughly 12 hours of light, 12 hours of darkness. If any man walk in the day, he stumbles not, because he seeth the light of the world. Look, it's still light time, boys. I'm not going to stumble. Because they're thinking, well, Lord, we can't go back there. You're going to die. They might kill you. And he's saying, you don't understand. I'm not dying until the time. There is a time. Sunset's coming. You know, we're just pulling out of deer season. And any of you who deer hunt, you know, you have the little chart that comes in your license guide that tells you sunset is at 5:15. That means I have to shoot this thing by 5:20, 5:25, whatever. You got 30 minutes or whatever it is for it to be legal. I can hunt to a specific time. Then it's dark and I can't hunt anymore. Well, Jesus is saying it's still daytime. Yeah, it's getting late. Sunset's coming. It's close now, but it's still light and I'm still going to work. And his point with part of this is, you know, you're bulletproof. The Lord has a course for you and I to run. You're not going to die before the appointed hour. Now, it does say don't put the Lord to a foolish test. If you decide to run out and stand in traffic or headbutt a semi as it's going by, you'll find out that that was the appointed hour. But, you know, but until you've run your course, you've finished what the Lord has for you, you don't have to be all freaked out about is my time up. Jesus wasn't freaked out, and he said, it's still day, it's time for me to work, I need to go back. He says this, these things said he, and after he saith unto them, our friend Lazarus sleepeth, but I go that I may awake him out of sleep. Well, then said his disciples, Lord, if he sleep, he shall do well. Howbeit, Jesus spoke of his death, but they thought that he had spoken of taking of rest and sleep. Jesus, well, now, Lazarus is asleep. We've got to go wake him up. And the disciples are thinking, oh, ooh, he's getting some rest. That's a great thing. He's probably recuperating. Hopefully, he'll be up and around by the time we're there. We can hang out with him. Jesus is thinking, no, he's dead. You don't get it. But the reason why they don't get it is Jesus is talking about physical death. And when it comes to physical death, to Jesus, it's just sleep. It's just sleep. We think of it as something much bigger than that because it seems so, it's such a barrier for us. You know, we have all, in some degree or another, experienced death. You know, Some of you have lost parents. I don't know if any of you lost children, but friends. It's a freaky thing for us because we don't know experientially what's on the other side. And for Jesus, he does. He's not really freaked out about it. For him, it's just, he's asleep. I wake him up. No big deal. His disciples, they're thinking, oh, well, that's a good thing. He's resting. And then Jesus said unto them plainly, Lazarus is dead. And I'm glad for your sakes that I was not there, to the intent that you may believe. Nevertheless, let's go unto him. You know, there are times when Jesus has to say things plainly because they don't get it. I like that. There are a lot of places in the Gospels where it says, he said unto them so-and-so, and then they would say, and then he'd say, do you understand? And they'd say, uh-huh, and then the Gospel writer will tell us, but they really didn't understand what he meant. They just didn't want to look stupid. And, you know, so sometimes Jesus gets real plain, and to them he has to say, you don't get it, he's dead. But I'm glad he's dead. Now, it's hard to understand somebody whose friend just died saying, I'm glad he's dead. We know that he loves him, he's fond of him, and he loves him in a divine way. And yet, he says, I'm glad for your sake. He can be glad because he knows that there's no doubt in the outcome. He already knows what's going to happen. Take note of that. He knows now, a couple days away still, Lazarus is dead, and he knows what's going to happen. So he really is not concerned about it at all. In fact, he's glad because of the effect it's going to have on his disciples. Verse 16, then said Thomas, which is called Didymus, unto his fellow disciples, let us all go, that we may die with him. Didymus, it means the twin. There's a couple different ways of looking at that. Some people say that the reason why Thomas was called Didymus, the twin, is because he looked like Jesus. And so he was kind of his twin. I don't know, maybe. It may be that he was a twin, and we just don't hear about what happened to, you know, his other brother. When I read about Thomas, I have a tendency to think it's because he's my long-lost twin, personally. Thomas has a bad rap. Now, it's funny. You read different commentators, and you got to be careful when you read commentators because they don't all agree, you know? And some of them read this, and they said, see, this guy has faith. This guy, he's bold as a lion, and he doesn't care. Everybody else is scared about going back and facing the religious leaders, not Thomas. He's like, let's go die with him. I just don't buy that. I'm sorry. I don't. Personally, let me tell you a couple other things that Thomas says, and you'll understand why I think. In John chapter 14, when we get there, Jesus says, let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I'll come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there you may also be. And whither I go, you know, and the way you go, in the way you know. And then we have recorded these words of Thomas. Thomas saith unto him, Lord, we know not whither you're going, and how can we know the way? Thomas is like, we know the way. I don't know where you're going. What are you talking about? You're just making no sense to me at all. And then Jesus says, I am the way and the truth and the life. After his death, in John chapter 20, in his resurrection, Jesus shows up in the midst of the disciples, except for Thomas is not there. In chapter 20, verse 24, it says, but Thomas, one of the 12, called Didymus, the twin, was not with him when Jesus came. Now again, some commentators have said, well, that's because all the other guys were scared and up in a closet, but Thomas, he was bold as a lion. He didn't care what anybody thought. He was out on the street. He wasn't afraid. They must not have read the rest of the chapter, because it says this. It said, and the other disciples therefore said unto him, we have seen the Lord. But he said unto them, except I see in his hands the print of the nails, and I put my finger into the print of the nails, and thrust my hand into his side, I will not believe. And then Jesus shows up in verse 27, and he saith unto Thomas, reach hither thy finger, and behold my hands. You know, put the finger through. Reach hither thy hand, and thrust it into my side, and be not faithless, but believing. I think Thomas... And then Thomas answered and said to him, my Lord and my God. When Thomas gets it, he comes up big. He says, "My Lord and my God." He actually calls Jesus God. If you ever happen to run into, say, a Jehovah's Witness, take them to that verse. It reads the same in their version. I've got one at home. I checked it last night. Reads the same. Thomas, when Jesus reveals himself, says, "My Lord and my God." He calls Jesus God. Doesn't say he's Michael the Archangel. He says he's God. Thomas, when he finally gets it. But I think here, back in John chapter 11, he's just being sarcastic. Because it says, then said Thomas, which is called Didymus, unto his fellow disciples. Jesus says, "We're going back." And then he turns around to all the other guys, rolls his eyes, and says, "Sure, let's go die with them." Why not? Whatever you... That's what I would have said. And that's what Thomas says, I think. Let's just go die with them. And when Jesus came, it says in verse 17, he found that he had lain in the grave 4 days already. 4 days he's been in the ground, and that'll be significant. We'll talk about it in a minute. Now, Bethany was nigh unto Jerusalem, about 15 furlongs off. For those of you who aren't race fans, that's about 2 miles. And many of the Jews came to Martha and Mary to comfort them concerning their brother. When he died, and again, he was presumably a younger guy. We don't know how old he was, but Martha and Mary are quite distraught, and a lot of people showed up to comfort. And it's a weird time. Any of you who've gone through that, it's a very weird time, because you don't know how to deal with it. I have never really met anybody who dealt with it well. Herbie Clay does a pretty good job. Any of you who knows The Undertaker, Herbie deals with it pretty well, but I've only seen him deal with it when he's not personally attached. I don't know how he deals with it when it's someone personal. But in my conversations with him, he has a good outlook, I'll be honest. But by and large, people don't really know how to deal with death. It's almost like they were never supposed to know how to deal with death. Like that wasn't the normal behavior. We're told, and we read it last week when we were in Romans chapter 6, sin and death entered through one man. The original design, it was not that way. We see when everything is restored and put back later on, the killing and the dying and the devouring that entered in through Adam is reversed, and the lion lays down with a lamb, and the lion eats grass like an ox. But right now, it's like all of this stuff happened because of what Adam did, and we just don't have the software to deal with that problem. Some people get really quiet. Some people won't shut up. Some people get really nervous. Some people get really mad. I mean, everybody deals, and we're going to see Mary and Martha, two girls, they're going to have very similar sounding reactions, but they're very different in how they're dealing with this because their brother has died. And he's been in the ground 4 days and know Jesus. And these are people who know who Jesus is. They know, Martha's going to say, "Oh, I know you're the Christ." They know who he is. He didn't show up for 4 days. And they know what would have happened if he'd have shown up. And they're dealing with that. And so all these people are coming out and they're trying to comfort them. And you just don't know how to do it. It says in verse 20, "Then Martha, as soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, went and met him. But Mary sat still in the house." The custom was, you wouldn't do that. You would stay back. I mean, you don't run out and meet, especially a woman wouldn't run out and meet a man coming. But Martha doesn't much care. Martha, verse 21, "Then said Martha unto Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother had not died." What does she mean by that? To really understand what's going on, a lot of times you need to put yourself into the position of these people here and try to figure out who they are. We have a couple instances of what Martha and Mary are like. The most famous one is in Luke chapter 10. That's already happened at this point. In Luke chapter 10, verse 38, it says, "Now it came to pass as they went that he entered into a certain village, and a certain woman named Martha received him into her house. And she had a sister called Mary, which also sat at Jesus' feet and heard his word. But Martha was cumbered about much serving, and came to him and said, Lord, dost thou not care that my sister has left me to serve alone? Bid her therefore that she help me. And Jesus answered and said unto her, Martha, Martha, thou art careful and troubled about many things, but one thing is needful, and Mary has chosen that good part, which shall not be taken away from her." Martha and Mary. Martha's the server. She's the organizer. She's the planner. She's the, somebody's coming over. Okay, we got to clean over here. We got to cook that. We got to go kill that. We got to get this, make some bread, do this thing, get everything together, clean the floors, make sure the couch is right, hide all the toys, put away the dirty clothes, you know, throw them in the, put the dishes in the oven. You know, all the things that we do when companies come. And I remember at one point when we were trying to sell our house out in Springfield, and it was like a year. It was a long time. And the showings were few and far between. So when a showing, somebody actually wanted to come out there and look at that house, you did whatever you had to do. And there was one time where my wife was gone. My kids were gone down in Pennsylvania. I got a call from the realtor saying, yeah, we want to show your house. And I'm thinking, oh, my, you know. So I just basically got every laundry basket I could find, and I'm filling them with dishes and with toys and clothes, and I just pack my car with, like, the contents of my house. Take off, you know. Clean. What are you going to do? Well, here, Martha's the kind that she organizes stuff, and she cleans. She makes sure stuff is going on. Jesus shows up, and Mary just plops herself down to listen to Jesus, and Martha's kind of mad about it. And she says to Jesus, don't you even care that she left me? And she says she left me, which means it sounds like Mary was doing stuff for a while, but then she left to go listen to Jesus, and yet Martha's thinking there's more that needs to be done. There's a lot of stuff yet. I mean, you bring in, look, you show up with 12 guys every time you come through the door. We got a lot to do here. You can't just, you know. Don't you even care that she left me? Make her help me. Don't you even care? And then Jesus says, Martha, Martha, you're busy about a lot of stuff, but there's only really one thing that's necessary, and Mary's chosen that. I'm not going to take that away from her. Well, now Martha comes out to him. Same Martha, probably Martha who organized the funeral procession, Martha who took care of the undertaker, Martha who made sure that there was enough food for all of the guests coming to the wake and all of that. Martha taking care of all the details. And she comes out, she hears Jesus is coming. Oh, good, I'm glad he's coming because I got something to say to him. And she comes out, and it's almost as if she asks the same question she asks back in Luke chapter 10. She says, if you'd been here, my brother wouldn't have died. And it's almost the same question. Don't you even care? You could have saved him. Don't even care. Same question. If you'd been here, my brother would not have died. And she says in verse 22, but I know that even now, whatsoever thou wilt ask of God, God will give it to thee. We're going to see as we go through this, it's not because she's saying, well, but I know you can bring him back to life. She's not saying that, because when they get to the tomb, he's going to say, roll away the stone. And even after this, what he's going to say to her in the next couple of verses, she says, Lord, he stinks. You sure you want to do that? I mean, Martha's not thinking that this is going to happen now. It's more like she's saying, I know that even now, whatsoever thou wilt ask of God, he will give it to thee. So why didn't you ask? I mean, that's the question. And look, it comes down with me and with you. If you're a Christian, you're a believer in Christ, when you ask him for something, I don't have any doubts that he can do it. I never doubt, you know, when I've had a sick child and I pray, Lord, you know, could you heal my child? When my wife and I were pregnant with our first 7 months into it and we went to the doctor's office and he didn't hear a heartbeat, and then we waited 2 weeks before she finally went into labor, there wasn't a day when I thought he wasn't able to miraculously start that heart again and keep bring that baby. I never thought. It was never a question of can you. It's a question of will you? Would you? You know? Because you know what Martha's thinking? Lord, we're your friends. We open our home to you every time you come through here. We love you. We tell other people about you. We talk about how awesome you are and how you're healing all these people. Why not us? Why everybody else? Why does everybody else get to be healed? Why does everybody else have all their problems go away? Why is it my brother has to die? Why would you don't care? You don't even care. Do you even love us? Why didn't you ask? We know. Look, if you'd asked, you could have done anything you wanted. Why not us? Is there something with us? We love you. Why not us? Don't you care? He answers her. Jesus saith unto her, thy brother shall rise again. And Martha saith unto him, I know that he shall rise again in the resurrection at the last day. He's saying, look, and she's not understanding. He's saying, your brother's going to rise again. Now, he knows it's going to be in about 15 minutes your brother's going to rise again. She's thinking it's going to be the last day. She's obviously not a Sadducee. The Sadducees don't believe in the resurrection. They don't believe in heaven. She's Pharisee. She knows. Her theology is okay. She knows that there is a resurrection, that, you know, as Job said, that even though worms eat my body, I'm going to stand and my eyes are going to see him again. I know my Redeemer lives. She knows all that. But she's basically telling Jesus, I'm not really looking for a theology lesson right now, okay? I want my brother back. You're not understanding. The sweet by and by is precious little comfort when my brother just died. I want my brother. And, you know, look, it's hard. You try to comfort somebody, and what do you say? Well, were they a Christian? That's a tough question to ask at all. Because what if they say no? What do you got then? Well, at least they lived a good life. I mean, you can't say that. And if it's yes, they already know that. But that's not what you're looking for when you're missing somebody. Death is separation. Death is losing the very present reality of them. If you're a Christian and somebody you love dies, you know you're going to see him again. But that's so far off. At least it seems so far off. And you're looking for him now. She's looking for short term. She's not looking for that down the road. She said, you know, Lord, I'm not looking for theology. But Jesus' answer to her shows that this just isn't theological. This is quite personal. You're not understanding. Jesus said unto her, and who but God could say this? I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die. Believest thou this? I am the resurrection and I am the life. It's not about a time. It's not about an event. It's about a person, and I am that person, and I'm here. You don't understand. I'm here. He says something interesting, and when you think about it for a minute, how does this work? He that believes in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. How is somebody who is dead believe in him? Because once you're dead, you're dead. You know, how does that work? And then he says, whosoever is alive or liveth and believes in me, he shall never die. And she's got to be trying to wrap her brain around this because she's thinking, well, you know, he's dead at this point, so how's he going to believe? And he believed before he died. He believed in you. We know that that was true. What do you mean he won't die? And well, the thing is, Jesus is talking about spiritual death. He's not talking about physical death. Those are two very different things. To him, physical death is not the end. It's just a change from one place to the other. It's a location thing more than anything else. It tells us when Adam was in the garden, the Lord said to Adam, you can have all of this stuff, all the trees, all the fruit, all the everything, except for that one tree. The day that you eat of that, you shall surely die. The day that you eat, you shall surely die. Now, when he ate of that, he lived another 900 years, had kids. So he didn't physically die the day that he ate, but he spiritually died. Something happened there. And it said after that that he had a son, and that son, it's in Genesis, is it 5, I think, was born in his image and likeness. Whereas Adam was created in God's image and likeness, Seth was created in Adam's likeness, which was spiritually dead, and that continued. Death reigned throughout history after Adam. But there is a spiritual death. To Jesus, physical death is pretty much just sleep. He says in Luke chapter 12, he says, and I say unto you, my friends, be not afraid of them that kill the body, and after that have no more that they can do to you. But I will forewarn you whom you shall fear. Fear him which, after he is killed, hath the power to cast into hell. Yeah, I say unto you, fear him. When you get into Revelation, Jesus talks, church at Smyrna, Revelation chapter 2, and he says, he that overcomes, well, let me read it. Fear none of those things, this is Revelation 2:10, fear none of those things which you shall suffer. Behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison that you may be tried, and you'll have tribulation 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death, and I'll give thee a crown of life. He that has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. He that overcometh shall not be hurt of the second death. And then in chapter 21, it talks about the second death being, you know, being in a lake of fire that burns with fire and brimstone. There's the first death, the second death. The first death is just passing from one place to another. You and I are a soul that lives in a body. And if you've become alive, you have a spiritual connection with God. You have a spirit. Your soul lives in your body, and your soul is you. It's your consciousness, your emotion, your personality, all that stuff. It's you. And you know that you are you. And if you have a horrible chainsaw accident so that, you know, you're missing some digits, you're still you. You lose an arm, you're still you. you lose both arms and both legs. You're a whole lot less mobile, but you're still you. You're the same person, the same personality. I mean, that is you. And when you die, the body part may die, the container, the baggie that holds the sandwich may die, but the sandwich, the good part of you, the part that's eternal, that continues to live on. The question is, what happens with the good part of you after you die? You know, Jesus says, the basic paraphrase, if you're only born once, then you're going to die twice. You're going to die physically, and then you're going to die spiritually in the lake of fire forever, which he talks about, you know, the worm dieth not, the fire is not quenched. It's not a nice thing. The smoke of their torment goes up forever, it says in Revelation. If you're born twice, like he said to Nicodemus, a man must be born again. And Nicodemus is old, and he's like, I'm trying to do the mental picture here. Am I going to climb in my mother's womb? I don't see that happening. And Jesus says, no, I've talked to you about, you know, spiritual things here, not just earthly things. There's a spiritual birth that has to happen. If you were born again spiritually, see, if we come to Jesus dead, which we all are born spiritually dead, if we come to him like he says here, I am the resurrection and life. He that believeth me, though he were dead, if you believe in him, yet shall he live. You become spiritually alive. At that point, you're born again. The spirit part of you comes alive. God's spirit comes into you. You have a relationship with God. If that happens, you'll never die. Your body may cease to exist for a while. But spiritually, you go somewhere else. You know, Paul tells us that to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. We know that something happens there and you move on. But if you believe in him, you'll never die. And then he says to him, do you believe this? Do you believe it? And she saith unto him, yea, Lord, I believe that thou art the Christ, the Son of God, which should come into the world. Now, she doesn't get it all, because she's going to say, they get to the tomb. Lord, you don't want to do that. I don't think you want to open that. This isn't going to be pretty. Because she still doesn't know what he's going to do. But here she is, and she's severely disappointed. I mean, give Martha this. She's upset. She's severely disappointed. She still doesn't understand. But yet she believes. She doesn't say, forget it, I've had enough, I don't care about you anymore. No. Yeah, I believe that you are the Christ. Even if she doesn't know what all that means, which means, you know, you and I don't have to understand it all. All we have to do is believe that he is who he said he is. And when she had so said, she went her way and called Mary, her sister, secretly, saying, the Master is come, he calls for you. And as soon as she heard that, she arose quickly and came unto him. Now Jesus was not yet come into the town, but was in that place where Martha had met him. The Jews then, which were with her in the house and comforted her, when they saw Mary, that she rose up hastily and went out, followed her, saying, she goeth unto the grave to weep there. And when Mary was come where Jesus was and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying unto him, Lord, same thing pretty much her sister said, if thou had been here, my brother had not died. Mary, we see her three times. The first time, she's sitting at Jesus' feet. When he's there, he's teaching, and she's just drinking it all in. Everything's happy. It's great. Jesus is in her house. You know, Martha's tweaked because of the serving, but she's having a great time. She's sitting at his feet. Now she is in mourning. She's in pain. She's distraught. She still doesn't understand why. And where does she go? Right to Jesus' feet. We're going to see her in the next chapter. Jesus is getting ready for his burial. Things are not right. Mary, more than anybody else, the disciples don't even seem to know what's going on. Mary somehow clues in on this, and she's sitting at his feet, and she's crying on his feet. She pours the ointment. She wipes him with her hair. Mary is always at Jesus' feet. Good times, bad times, that's where she is. She knows that's where comfort is. She goes there with her questions. If you had been here, my brother had not died. I think there is a question, why weren't you here? Why weren't you here? Why didn't you come through? Why didn't you do what it is that I know you know how to do? You're the only one who can do it if you'd have been here. I still love you, but if you had been here. And look what he does. When Jesus therefore saw her weeping, and the Jews also weeping, which came with her, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled, and said, where have you laid him? And they said unto him, Lord, come and see. And the shortest verse in the Bible, good place to start your memorization. Jesus wept. When he sees what's going on, first it says he groaned in the spirit and was troubled. It means he's mad. He's a little angry. He's angry, he's indignant. Ticks him off. When he sees all of this weeping and everything going on, it makes him angry. Then it says he wept. Now, the weeping, which, you know, she was doing in verse 33, is more of the wailing and the sobbing. His wasn't as, I don't think it was as out of control as all that, but he was showing sorrow. And you got to ask yourself, why was he crying? Because he knows what's going to happen in about 5 minutes now. He knows what's going to happen. He's not upset for Lazarus. If anything, he should cry for Lazarus after he brings him back, because Lazarus is in paradise, and then he gets yanked back into some grave clothes in a tomb. I mean, Lazarus, if anybody should be bummed in the story, it should be Lazarus. I got to go through that again? Are you kidding me? It's like making me go back through junior high. I mean, I graduated once. Now I got to go back through puberty. I got to go back through life again. But he's not weeping because he's upset about Lazarus. He's weeping because he's mad and he's sad about what his friends have to go through because of sin and death in this world. And that's important to note. There are some people who think that God is apathetic, that he doesn't care. You know, wildfires rage, typhoons hit, and people die, and they think, where's God in all of this? He doesn't care. Well, Hebrews chapter 1 says this: God, who at sundry times and in diverse manners spake in times past unto the fathers by the prophets, has in these last days spoken to us by his Son, whom he has appointed heir of all things, by whom also he made the worlds, who being the brightness of his glory and the express image of his person. If there's any question you want to know, what does God think about something, you take a look at Jesus Christ, because he is the face to go with the emotions of God. When you see Jesus Christ angry over death, which is where Martha was, and you see him weeping over death, which is where Mary was, you know that God is angry about death, and he's also sad about the stuff that we have to deal with. He's got compassion. You know, you never see it say Jesus laughed. I know he laughed because he had such guys that he picked. I mean, how could you not? They're arguing about who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom. He's got Peter saying, it's a good thing we're here, Lord. Huh, you know, we should build 3 tents. And then God interrupts him from heaven and says, you know, that's my son. Just listen, shut up and listen, you know, hear him. He gets interrupted by all 3 members of the Trinity. And yet he had to laugh, but yet it doesn't say that because, you know, I joke a lot. I laugh a lot. I'm sarcastic like Thomas. The problem with that is some people think that's really funny, and then sometimes people get really hurt by that. And they think you don't care, when that's not the case. You know, usually when I tease somebody, I tease them because I like them. I tease them in areas that I am so horribly weak in that if they knew me at all, they'd know that the only reason I'm making fun of you is because I'm really making fun of me. But it's never recorded, even though I'm sure he laughed because he was a guy that everybody liked to come to. It's never recorded because he never isolated anybody. He never made anybody feel like he didn't care, because he does care. And he weeps and he's angry. And he's mad at sin, he's mad at death, he's mad at the pain of his friends. And Jesus is not somebody, again, like your kid in traffic. He has to act. He's not gonna go through that and not do anything about it. And maybe 4 days later, which is not the timing they wanted, but when it happens, it's gonna change everything. I think Martha needed to know some truth about who he was. That's why he answered that way. Mary didn't need any truth about who he was. Mary just needed some compassion. So he gave her what she needed. The Jews, it says, then said the Jews, behold how he loved him. And some of them said, could not this man, which opened the eyes of the blind, have caused that even this man should not have died? Yep, he could have, but he didn't. Jesus therefore, again groaning in himself, cometh to the grave. It was a cave, and a stone lay upon it. In the Middle East, especially a couple thousand years ago, embalming didn't really happen. They didn't do that. Egyptians made that an art form. My kids have learned some of that in homeschooling, and it's pretty fascinating the way the Egyptians would suck their brains out and do all these different things, take their organs, put them in pots, all the different things they do. The Jews, no, they didn't do that. Somebody died, the funeral happened pretty much right then, and you got them, you know, they might put spices on them, like they'd put Jesus' body is anointed with spices to kill the smell that's going to come, but they just put you in the ground. They put you in a cave. sometimes they would use a sarcophagus, but even the caves would be called a sarcophagus. Sarcophagus is a nice word that means flesh eater. The caves, a lot of them would be limestone caves. They put the bodies in there, and the limestone really helps the process happen fast to eat the flesh away. And then after a couple years, they would actually have a second burial ceremony, and they would have an ossuary. They'd have a family cave. They'd have multiple laying places where you'd put a body, and the decomposition would happen. After a couple years in one of those caves, you'd be left mostly with a pile of bones, and they would open an ossuary, which is a bone box. You might have seen in the news where the James ossuary was supposedly found, where they found an ossuary that has an inscription on the side that says James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus, or something on the side, and they think it might be James's half-brother's box. Don't know. But anyways, they would scrape the bones into the box and seal that up, and then they'd have a new place to lay the next person who died. So they would bury him, and then they'd put a rock in front for two reasons. One, keep the critters out, because, you know, you don't want to find your brother drugged through town by the dogs. So you want to leave him in the cave with a rock there, but also to keep the smell in, because as we're going to see, there's some stuff that happens when you die. It was a cave, and then a stone lay upon it. And Jesus said, take ye away the stone. Martha, the practical one, the sister of him that was dead, saith unto him, Lord, by this time he stinketh, for he's been dead 4 days. Now, there are a couple instances where Jesus raises the dead that we're told about. There's Jairus' daughter who died. He came to her, brought her back to life. The widow of Nain's son, who he interrupts the funeral procession. But again, that would happen quick, probably within a few hours or more of when he died, and brings him back to life. This is 4 days. Some of the commentators say that, you know, the Jews had a tradition that the soul would hang around the body for 3 days with the hopes of getting back in, but after 3 days it would give up and leave. Nothing biblical about that, but whatever the case, maybe just because of that tradition, Jesus waited 4 days. We're really insulated from many things. You know, we were talking at Thanksgiving. You know, we're presented with this bird in a plastic wrap with a little timer that's already stuck in it, and then, you know, a couple pieces wrapped up nicely in a little bag in case you want to stick them into the body for flavor. But by and large, you know, we get this processed bird presented to us, and we don't have to go through the nastiness of preparing a bird for Thanksgiving. I grew up on a farm, and I saw horrible things that I had to go through as a child with lambs and with turkeys and with sheep and with pigs and with cows, and it's not a pretty thing, you know. The butcher's you got to be a certain type of person to be a butcher to do that thing. Death is the same way, because what happens here in our society, somebody dies. If I think 90-something percent of the people die in a hospital. It's not the way it used to be, but, you know, some people die at home. But even when somebody dies at home, they call the undertaker, and Hervey shows up with his coach, and they take the body out, and they prepare the body. And you see them, maybe see them dead. Next time you see them, if you see them at all, a lot of places do a closed casket. And, you know, when I die, by all means, keep the lid down. Ain't nobody got to see that. It's bad enough looking as it is now. It's only going to be better. And they never quite get it right, you know, because Hervey's not really up on how I wear my hair, and he's got to, you know, try to push stuff around, you know. But we see this body, and it's been embalmed, and it's been chemically painted and all of this stuff to make it look as presentable as possible before they put it away. What really happens when somebody dies, there are several things that happen. First of all, there are enzymes that are in your body, and they have functions in your body. They help you digest food. They help you take care of problematic areas. Well, those things stay in check because your body has natural defenses that keep them in check. When you die, the heart stops beating, the blood starts going, stops going, and then those things, as the cells begin to die, the enzymes take over, and they stop just digesting food, and they start digesting you, and they start breaking out of cell walls, and they start doing. Not only that, but you and I all have a number of bacteria that live in your body that are healthy bacteria. That's why they say eat the yogurt, you know, so that those bacteria can help break down your food. And those little critters get a smorgasbord once you die. They begin to go full bore, and it's not just food that they're digesting, but they start digesting you. Within 2 to 3 hours, and yes, I had to study all this last night, just so you know. I went to some websites, I saw some video. I mean, it was within a few hours of when you die, rigor mortis sets in, because your muscles, you know how when you work your muscles out, they get sore? they get tired. It's lactic acid that gets released when your muscles work out after you stop. Well, depending on how much activity you've done just before your body dies, lactic acid gets released, and within a couple hours of dying, you stiffen up. Your muscles stiffen up. It's called rigor mortis. That happens within 2 to 3 hours, and then it gradually releases itself over the next 2 days or so until you're loose again. Your blood that's coursing through your body, pumping, doing all its thing, when it stops moving, starts to separate, and the heavy parts, all of the red, heavy, dark parts sink to the bottom of your body. So any place that isn't touching but is in a low part, like the small of your back and everything, all of the dark stuff pools and all of the light stuff rises. That's why after people die very shortly and they start to look pale and kind of yellowish, and the body separates. All of the soft organs very shortly on begin to melt, really, is what happens. And over the next couple days, the eyes will melt, the liver will melt, the brain will melt. They'll all start to, and as that fluid just pours out or through your body, it also is like slopping the hogs for the bacteria, because that's just food. And so they do what it is they do. Now, when your bacteria are in your intestines and things, and they're doing their work and they're digesting things, they consume and they secrete. And what they put off is gas, which you then also put off yourself in various ways. We're adults, we know how that works. Well, when you die, they continue to eat and they continue to go and they continue to put off more and more gas. But the ability for you to release that gas goes when you die, so it builds. And so you start to swell and you start to bloat. Eventually, it will go to the place where you'll burst open and the gas will have to get out. Then there's the other thing that... See, when you die, there's a couple ways that they... You ever wonder, some of you guys probably watch CSI on those shows, so you know exactly how they know the time of death. Well, when it's early on, the thermometer is the great, there's a formula based upon, you know, how the body cools. Starts out 98.6, I think there's a formula, they divide 98.2 minus times what, I don't know, I forget what it was. But anyways, they can stick a thermometer in, and as you cool and start to assume room temperature, they can gauge how old you're, but that happens within I don't know how many hours. So after that, the way that they time of death, immediately upon death, no matter where you're at, it's slower in an air-conditioned place, but there are little flies all around our world. I don't know if you know that like to lay eggs. You ever notice how you wake up in the morning and when that banana's been there one day too long, all of a sudden you go to reach for that black banana and this little thing of flies come up? Well, when you die, they find you. Doesn't matter where you are. You can put the stone in there, but they find you. And they actually can tell how long you've been dead by... They know how fast certain types of flies reproduce and when they turn into larvae and they turn into maggots, they turn into whatever. And so they measure that in you and they can grow some to say, oh yeah, he's been dead for 2.5 days because the flies are at this. I mean, that stuff starts going too. So 4 days in, this isn't a resuscitation. Nobody's doing mouth to mouth with him because there's bad stuff going on. You know, I mean, he's dead and he stinketh. He's rotting. That's the point. The point is this has gone beyond a near-death experience. This is a total death experience. That's a good thing, because you and I aren't going to become near dead. We're going to become total dead. We're going to become rotting, stinketh. That's what happens to our bodies. So Mary says, Martha says, God, you don't, Jesus, you really don't want to pull that away because he stinketh. And Jesus saith unto her, said I not unto thee that if thou wouldest believe, thou should see the glory of God? Now, just in case you're one of those people who've been told that it's faith, it's your faith. If you can just believe, if you have the faith to believe, God can do this miracle. But you got to have faith. You got to believe. And so I know your finger's off and it's spurting blood, but you say, I believe I'm whole and Jesus can make you whole. That's not the case. He says to Martha, didn't I tell you if you believe, Martha ain't believing. She doesn't get it. You know, Lazarus ain't, he stinketh. He ain't believing nothing because he's in the ground stinketh. And yet, it's not the power of your faith. And don't let anybody put that trip on you, because somebody put that trip on my family when my father was dying of cancer. Don't give him morphine. Don't you do it. Because if you do that, it'll take away his mind and he won't have the faith. He won't have the ability to have the faith necessary to be healed. I wasn't there that day, which was a good thing, because we would have had a talk. But the truth is, it's not Martha's faith. It's not Mary's faith. It's certainly not Lazarus' faith. it's the object of their faith, which is Jesus. It says, they took away the stone from the place where the dead was laid, and Jesus lifted up his eyes, and he said, Father, I thank thee that thou hast heard me. And I knew that thou hearest me always, but because of the people which stand by, I said it, that they may believe that thou hast sent me. His prayer, and all of that happened 4 days ago. He knew exactly what was going on. He knew that Lazarus was dead. He knew that he was going to be raised again. But now he's praying out loud just so that everybody knows that he is in communion with the Father. And when he had thus spoken, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. A loud voice. Now, where did it go to? It's interesting. A couple things to note. He says, Lazarus, come forth. Lazarus is still Lazarus. Wherever Lazarus is, he hasn't become part of the great nothingness of the universe, global, harmonic, convergent home. He's none of that, okay? He's still Lazarus. Wherever he is, he's still Lazarus. In fact, you know, some of the people have said, he had to say, Lazarus, come forth. If he had just said, come forth, the place would have emptied. You know, everybody to come out. So he had to be specific, and he called one person, Lazarus, come forth. Wherever Lazarus was, he had to come forth. Now, there probably wasn't, you know, I can just picture Lazarus saying, you got to be kidding me. I don't want to go back there. I mean, this is awesome. This is the, when Paul was caught up and he saw, you know, when I think it was when he was stoned and drug out of the city, left for dead. I think he did die. He sees heaven and he comes down. And he says, you know, it was, let me see. I can't even tell you. It'd be a crime if I tried to describe it because my words can't describe what I saw there. And Lazarus is in that place. He's called back. Your soul doesn't sleep, okay? The Bible tells us, Paul says, to be absent from the body is to be present from the Lord. In 1 Kings chapter 17, Elijah's there. He's staying with a widow. The widow's son dies. Elijah prays to the Lord. And it says in 1 Kings 17, 22, and the Lord heard the voice of Elijah, and the soul of the child came into him again, and he revived. His soul was somewhere else. It came back. It wasn't there and just asleep. There's no soul sleep. You step out of this world, you step into the presence of the Lord in the next. That's the way it works. And so when, you know, in Revelation chapter 6, we see the souls of those who've been martyred in the tribulation under the altar crying out saying, Lord, how long? They're there. They're not sleeping somewhere. He says, Lazarus, come forth. And he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave clothes. And his face was bound about with a napkin. And Jesus said unto them, loose him and let him go. Poor Lazarus, if anyone should be crying, it should be him. He comes out. He was in, you know, linen, fine and white, glorified body. And now all of a sudden he's wearing. And do the clothes stinketh? I mean, because they're on him, you know. Do they get magically cleaned up? I don't know. But Jesus says, you got to unwrap him. And, of course, everybody there is thinking, I'm not going to touch him. I mean, this is a Scooby-Doo, you know, moment coming out of the row. You know, nobody wants to touch him. This is just freaky. They're all dying here. And yet he comes out. Jesus says, unwrap him. And when that happens, many of the Jews which came to Mary and had seen the things which Jesus did believed on him. Many people believed when they saw this. But some of them went their ways to the Pharisees and told them what things Jesus had done. Many believed, but some didn't. Isn't that amazing? Some people would actually see a guy who's been rotting, stinking, dead for 4 days come back to life. And they don't believe. They instead go, we're going to tell on you for what you did. And they go find the Pharisees and they say, he's raising people from the dead. You got to do something about this. But yet in the other story of the other Lazarus in Luke chapter 16, there's Lazarus the beggar and there's the rich man, and they go to their separate places. The rich man's in torment, and he says, Abraham, send somebody back to tell my brothers. If I can't at least be comforted here, send Lazarus back to tell my brothers so that they don't come to this place. And then Abraham says, they've got Moses and the prophets. They've got the testimony of the scripture. Let them believe that. And the man in torment says, no. But if somebody was to come back from the dead, they'd believe. And Abraham says, no, because if they won't believe Moses and the prophets, even if somebody comes back from the dead, they're not going to believe. And here we have some people who see a man come back from the dead, and yet they don't believe. Jesus said, he that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. are you dead? Or are you alive? Because if you have not been born again, if you have not asked Christ to forgive your sins, become the Lord of your life, and been born again spiritually, you are that dead person. And if you leave this planet before you become born again, before you are born that second time, born once, die twice. You don't have to be. If you believe on him, even if you're in that state, if you believe on him, though you were dead, you shall live. And you should ask yourself, whenever we're confronted with death, it's a great time to ask yourself, do I know where I would go if that Mack truck everybody is talking about is waiting for me out in the parking lot? You know, you don't know how much time you have. You need to know. It's important to note, if you do know him, that death, pain, and sickness are universal. And the cry of two ladies who knew him quite well were, do you even care? Why weren't you here? But the truth is, through their temporary suffering, many people believed. See, we read this, and we come to this chapter, John chapter 11, and I read this, getting ready to teach this, you know, beginning of last week, I start reading through it, and I think, oh yeah, I love this chapter. This is awesome. Because he stinketh. Anytime you get to talk about somebody stinking, it's great. I love this chapter. I love what happens at the end. They didn't read the end. They lived the end. For them going through this, all they know is that their brother's dead. And the comfort that they know is, well, on the last day, he's going to get raised again. But if they had known, yeah, but it's only going to be 4 days. I mean, think about that for a minute. Think about somebody you know is dying, and you're told they're going to die. But they're going to die, but 4 days later, they're going to come back. Could you deal with those 4 days? Darn right, I could deal with those 4 days. I'd have everybody I know come and be part of this, see, because you wait and see what happens. 4 days. I can wait 4 days. 4 days isn't bad. What if he said, well, it's going to be a week, I'm a little further away, it's going to be a week. Week's harder. You know, the longer it goes, you miss them, it's going to be hard, but you could do a week. What if it was 4 weeks? What if it was a month? They're going to be dead for a month. You're going to be without them for a month. But then they're coming back, and everybody's going to see. It'd be hard. I could do it, but it'd be harder. Well, what if it's a year? What if it was a year? What if he said, you're going to be dead, rotten in the ground for a year, but at the end of a year, they're going to come back perfectly healed. You're going to see them again. Would it change things? I think it would change things. Well, that's what you and I have for a promise. We just don't have a time frame, but we know we're going to come back. Like Job said, even though worms eat my body, I'm going to stand and my eyes are going to behold him because I know that my Redeemer lives. You and I have that promise. That's why Paul can say to us, I would not have you be ignorant, brethren, about them which were asleep, and sorrow as those that have no hope. See, when you and I experience death, we experience almost a selfish thing. Lazarus was not upset. Lazarus wasn't upset until he got brought back because he was going to have to go through it all again. His family was happy that he was back. He wasn't happy. We miss somebody when they die because we miss their presence. But if we're believers, we know it's not a goodbye. It's a see you later. See you at dinner. I hope you know, even though you haven't read the end of your chapter, that they're getting back up again. You're getting back up again. You don't need to be afraid because he is the resurrection and the life. And anybody, though they're dead, if they believe in him, yet shall they live. Amen. Let's pray. Lord, I pray, Father, that Lord, when we sing those songs that say, take my life, pour it out, to bring glory to your name. Lord, that even though it could mean something like what Mary and Martha go through here, we would not sorrow as those who have no hope. We would know that you are the resurrection and the life. Lord, if there's anyone here who doesn't know you, who has never met you, I pray, Father, they would not leave that way, but they would have the courage to come see me and pray and be introduced to the God who loved them enough to die for them. And Lord, if there's any of my brothers and sisters here who are going through those times where they're saying, Lord, where are you? I don't see you. They would know that you see and you hear. And you're angry at their pain, and you weep with them in their pain. But Lord, I pray that you would give them hope to know that it's just for a season. people may bring glory to you because of what they experience. Lord, I pray you would fill us with your Spirit. Give us the hope of our salvation. I pray you'd come quickly. We ask it in the name of Christ our King.